From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, no love, no money for the Great Lakes in the new Trump budget.
The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, that's zeroed out. It would go from $300 million a year to zero.
The water walkers, Anishinaabe people walking around the Great Lakes to honor the water.
As people see them walking and as people hear their message, they will then pay attention to the water and what's going on.
Will car makers throttle back on meeting fuel economy and emission standards? Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howe says, no, this isn't the auto industry of the 1960s.
These are not the people that said, we can't put catalytic converters on cars because it'll put us out of business. We can't put seatbelts in cars because it'll put us out of business. That is not the kind of people that are running these companies.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Pentagon, Homeland Security, big winners. The Great Lakes, Community Development Block Grants, the EPA, heating assistance for the poor, the arts, big losers. That's what we've learned from the budget plan released today by President Trump. So let's turn to Detroit Free Press Capitol Hill reporter Todd Spangler, who's been digging into all of this. Todd, what's the big message in this 53-page budget?
The big message in this budget is the level of cuts to programs that have been in place for a long, long time and which a lot of people count on being around for a long, long time to come. This really remakes federal spending as we know it, increases defense spending, but at the same time cuts back on a lot of programs that I think people are going to be very, very surprised to see cut.
So let's kind of get into these. What are some of the ways Michigan could feel these cuts?
Well, and we had reported on this before, but it turns out to be even more so than we thought. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which is a program that funds upwards of $300 million a year into wetlands restoration and anti-pollution projects, fish habitat, water quality programs, that's zeroed out. It would go from $300 million a year to zero. Now, realize that that's money that in the past when the Obama administration had talked about even trimming, you know, $25, $50 million out of that, people on both sides of the political aisle rose up and said, absolutely not, fought to keep it. It has been about $300 million a year for several years, and zeroing that out is going to land like a bombshell for members of Congress from Great Lakes states. I mean, that's just an enormous cut. Someplace else that's going to be felt across the entire nation, and specifically in communities like Detroit, but others across Michigan, it gets rid of the Community Development Block Grants. It's a program that's been around since the 1970s, specifically created to try to take federal money and help prop up urban areas where you had more poor people living, trying to help create economic development opportunities as well as provide for homeless shelters and senior citizen services, things like this. That would also be zeroed out in this budget if it were to pass. You know, in Michigan, that would cost about $110 million. That's how much the state would lose. In Detroit specifically, that'd be about $30 million. That would be hit. I mean, you'd see real consequences of losing that kind of money.
And I know low-income energy assistance is also on the chopping block.
Absolutely, yeah. That is something that, you know, got pumped up during the Obama administration, during the recession, funding to try to help people pay their heating bills, particularly low-income people, to pay their heating bills. That gets eliminated in this budget proposal, saying that it's duplicative and there may be other ways that local governments can pick up the slack on that. I think that in a lot of this, you're going to end up with states and local governments saying, we don't have the capacity, the ability, the resources to pick up this loss from the federal government. And anyway, our people are also sending federal tax dollars in to pay for this and not just pay for increases in defense spending, which this budget does propose.
How much of this proposed budget from President Trump seems to contradict promises that he made?
Well, that depends on how you look at it. This is really only a partial budget. This does not have the line-by-line items from each of the agencies that we're used to seeing when a budget proposal was made. We're told those will be coming in the months to come, probably sometime in May. Without those, it's hard to see exactly everything that he wants to do. And what they've said all along as well, they do have a plan, for instance, to fund infrastructure programs, to fund new roads and bridges and other things that they say are going to create lots of jobs. But no one has seen those proposals yet. So this is happening more in a vacuum without that being out there. So in many ways, this seems to go back on promises to help inner cities like Detroit. and to create more opportunities for people, for working class folks across the state. There are things here that, absolutely, when you're talking about heating assistance and community development funds, a lot of that does get spent elsewhere. You're talking about rural areas that are looking for opportunity. This cuts, you know, funding for rural airports, for instance, that people in the first district up north really do rely on. Are those going back on promises? You could see it that way. I think they would argue that it may look that way, but there's more to come, and wait and see what else we have for you. But seeing how that all is going to balance out is difficult at this point.
Detroit Free Press Capitol Hill reporter Todd Spangler. As always, Todd, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. And it's time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. And we're looking at President Trump's visit to the American Center for Mobility at Willow Run in Ypsilanti and talking about fuel economy standards and greenhouse gas emission standards. And Daniel, you say the president didn't roll back the tougher fuel economy standards that were set in 2011. So what did and didn't happen yesterday?
Well, what didn't happen was the environmental apocalypse that I think some people are already saying is upon us. What the president did is basically revive a deal that the Obama administration made with the automakers about 5 years ago that said that they would do a review of market conditions, technological advancement in 2017 and 2018 with an eye towards the three-year period of 2022 to 2025. Obama administration, right before leaving office, said, you know what? We don't need that review. You guys are doing great. Forget it. Let's move on.
Okay.
They've screamed bloody murder, said this is not right. This isn't fair. There's a lot of things that you need to understand about what's happening in the marketplace and what's not happening in the marketplace. And the administration said, not interested. What the Trump administration is doing is saying, okay, let's do that. Let's revive that process and take into account the market realities, the fact that small car sales are collapsing in the United States. The take rate for electric vehicles is only about 3% of sales. The fact that gasoline prices are closer to $2 a gallon than they are $4 a gallon. And the conventional wisdom is that that's going to continue for some time to come. And all of that has an impact in the marketplace. So you've got companies that, yes, are making record profits in the United States, but they're also, in case of Fiat Chrysler, killing car production because demand is collapsing. General Motors is idling shifts in small car plants. Ford is taking its compact production to Mexico because there's better uses for those plants in the United States.
When we talk about those smaller and more traditional cars that buyers don't want, that aren't selling like the trucks and SUVs, why don't the automakers just put that technology, the electric and the hybrid, on all of those big vehicles that consumers want?
Well, they do. You know, you can get a hybrid Chevy Suburban, for example, or a Yukon or a Tahoe. That's gettable. But they tend to cost more, not always. One of the things that manufacturers have tried to do is basically say, okay, you know, there is no premium for getting a hybrid Ford Fusion, for example, versus a regular gas Fusion. They've tried to address that in the marketplace, but I think people are somewhat suspicious of the technology. Mm-hmm. They understand the traditional gasoline engine, and gas is cheaper, and therefore the cost of ownership, as they look at it, is low.
But we should say, just because it's cheaper now doesn't mean, with the way the world is, that those oil prices can't ricochet right back up and everybody be crying at the pump as they're filling their SUV.
Yeah, but the one variable that has changed is American energy production. The United States has become one of the largest energy producers in the world, and it has had a dramatic impact on oil markets and oil prices around the world. And I don't think anybody expects that that's really going to turn around and change, particularly under this administration.
Daniel, why should companies' bottom lines be more important than reducing our dependence on foreign oil, keeping the atmosphere protected and preserved, because it's the only environment this Earth's ever going to get? I mean, the greater good over a bottom line and profits.
I don't think this is just about profitability. I mean, I think it's about a lot of variables. I mean, you know, you're asking companies to build vehicles that nobody's going to buy. You know, these companies were criticized fiercely during the bailout discussions for paying workers not to work. And so now you're going to expect them to build products that nobody's buying. One of the things that's happening here that I don't think people fully understand is these companies are really looking at walking away from entire segments of the market because of the world that they're now operating in. Profitability is important, and you need capital to run. And if investors don't want to invest in you because they don't think it's a good return and you're not going to show growth, guess what? They're not going to invest in you. And so what you're raising and the environmental aspects are important, no question about it. And I think if you talk to the people at these companies, they will tell you that. You know, this is not the auto industry of the 1960s. Very important point here. These are not the people that said, we can't put catalytic converters on cars because it'll put us out of business. We can't put seatbelts in cars because it'll put us out of business. That is not the kind of people that are running these companies. This industry is very much driven by technology. It's driven by a push towards electrification. It's driven by a push towards autonomous and self-driving cars, all of which have major impacts on the profitability of the companies, but also on achieving some of the same things that the environmental lobby wants to achieve. Emissions-free driving, for example. That is being driven by other parts of the world, particularly that are huge market draws, like China, mm-hmm. like the European Union. That's not going to go away. So whatever happens in this mid-cycle review, and frankly, I've talked to ranking executives who say, look, we're not asking anybody for a rollback here. All we're saying is, let's go back into this process that we agreed on, and let's look at the market conditions as they exist, not as you want them to be. And you can't assume a rate of electrification of 10% in the marketplace when the actual rate is 3%. That's a huge gulf, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can't assume that gas is going to be $4 a gallon because it was in 2011. Well, it's not now. And the likelihood that it's going to go back to $4 a gallon is probably not really good under normal market conditions. Now, if you have an exogenous shock or something in the Middle East, that's a different kettle of fish. But I think those are the questions that they're looking at. These companies, the other thing this person said to me is, we're betting big on electrification in our company. That's not going to change, regardless of what happens, regardless of how many pickups we sell in the United States. That's not going to change because that strategy is important for a lot of other parts of the world, which is also important for the growth of the companies.
So, and as you point out in your column today, you say you're among the first to say this is not a binary either or choice. It's both.
That's exactly right, and they have to do both.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Still to come, a children's book tells the story of Native Americans walking to save the Great Lakes. Then in 10 minutes, a first-of-its-kind facility offering people with autism and their families a comfortable, safe place to play. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. They're known as the Mother Earth Water Walkers. Two Anishinaabe grandmothers and a group of Anishinaabe women and men walking the perimeter of the Great Lakes, hoping to raise awareness of the environmental and man-made threats against the lakes. These Native American groups began walking in 2003, and since then, they've walked all of the 11,525 miles around the Great Lakes. And that's not all. They've walked other waterways around the country and continue to plan walks today. Their story is now told in a new children's book called Water Walkers, written by Brighton author Carol Trembath with illustrations by David W. Craig. The story follows an Ojibwe girl named Mai. Take a listen.
As I walked, I remembered my grandmother's words to her Ojibwe people. Our sacred water is in trouble. We will walk long distances with water in our copper pail and pray for the water with each step. We will circle the lakes to protect them for our children and our grandchildren. Grandmother planned to walk around each of the Great Lakes one by one. She taught me that it is our Ojibwe people's custom to watch over and protect the water. I thought about grandmother's words. I wondered how I could help. Grandmother told us we would start the first water walk around the big lake, Gichigami, Lake Superior. I wanted to go too, but my big sister Winona and Uncle Joe said, Mai, you are too little to go. My grandmother said, even our little ones can make ripples and waves. Mai will tell me what she sees, because she sees like the clever coyote. From then on, I became a water walker for Mother Earth.
That was Carol Trembath reading an excerpt of her children's book, Water Walkers, and she joins us now. So this story was inspired by Josephine Mandeman and the other real-life water walkers. And their mission was to walk around all of the Great Lakes to do exactly what?
Well, Josephine Mandaman is Ojibwe, and the chief of the Three Fires is Eddie Benton-Bonnet. Eddie Benton-Bonnet had a vision in 2003, and the vision was this, that in 30 years, if we do not take care of the water, an ounce of water will be the price of an ounce of gold. Josephine took up the challenge, and she decided to begin walking around the Great Lakes and down rivers and waterways to bring attention to the water. It's called collective consciousness. As people see them walking and as people hear their message, they will then pay attention to the water and what's going on.
And in your story, Little Mai is a great device because it helps you tell the story of what the water walkers did and why, and we learn about it through her eyes. What were the walks like?
Well, the real walks, the Native people get up every morning at 5:30 and they go to the water, they bless the water, they sing to the water, and they leave their gift of tobacco. It is symbolic. But these are sacred words, and I went on the Ohio River Walk and I saw on a rainy, gray day exactly what happened. These songs are sacred, and so they asked the TV cameras to be turned off. And again, they do believe that water is life-giving force, and just like we would pray to have someone who is sick be great in health again, they do the same, and they do this every day, and then they walk 40 to 50 miles a day. When they went around Lake Superior, it took them 36 days of walking. They are joined by other people when they go around cities, but yes, they have walked a tremendous amount of time.
And as we learned from reading your book, Water Walkers, they carry a copper pail. Why is that?
Copper is sacred to the Native American people. The reason is 5,000 years ago in the Midwest, they found copper in the UP. And ever since then, it has been one of their sacred elements. Whenever there is a situation in the Native reservations that someone is abused or in pain, they do take the copper pail around, walk around the reservation, and ask for donations with the copper pail.
So therefore, that copper pail is really for the Great Lakes.
Yes, it is.
Now, you've dedicated your book to this grandmother, Josephine, who came up with the idea. Tell us more about Josephine.
Josephine is an Ojibwe grandmother. She is not an elder. She has a great deal of strength and is an active, real-life Native American hero working every day to help the water.
Now, you are not Native American, are you?
No, I am not.
And how were you received when you started saying, I want to write this book? Was there any sense of, well, we'd rather have somebody from our side write it, or did they welcome you?
Well, there are two things going on here. The first is David W. Craig. He is the illustrator.
And David is Native American.
David is Native American, too. He was the only one that I sent the story to. And his agent called me back and said, David has been asked many times to do stories. This is the first one he's agreed to do. Now, how it's been received, I saw Josephine in Thanksgiving time 3 years ago, and I gave her a preliminary copy of the book, and she said, well, it's not accurate. I said, well, it's fiction. But she also emailed me in January, and she said, I had misgivings about what you are doing. She said, it is our tradition to speak orally or draw. That is not your tradition. I respect that. But we asked in ceremony, what is it that she wants, meaning me? Is it for ego, fame, or money? And the answer came back, it is for the water, simply for the water. And so I give you my blessing and can rest easy. I have dedicated the book to her. She has allowed me to put her picture into the book and put in that email so Native American people will understand that I'm not in it for the trophy. I'm in it to help. I'm on a mission to help.
And I know you're going into schools and presenting a learning program tied around that, harkening back to your years as a teacher and librarian. What's in the program?
The purpose of this is to bring an awareness to children and understand their stewardship that they need to protect and take care of the water. It has been said over and over that our next crisis will not be oil. Our next crisis is going to be water.
And are you planning more stories about Mai? She's an adorable little girl.
Yes, of course I am. The next story will be called Stepping Stones, and it's about her journey around Lake Michigan.
We start with Superior and moving on to Michigan, so there are certainly more stories. Well, it is absolutely a beautiful story, and I know you're hoping that the children who read this become more aware than ever about preserving the Great Lakes.
Absolutely.
Carol Trembeth of Brighton, her children's book is Water Walkers, and again, beautifully illustrated by David W. Craig. You can check out her website, caroltrembeth.com, if you want to find out more about having that learning program brought to your school. Thank you so much for being with us.
I need to say, in Ojibwe, chi migwich, which means in Ojibwe, thank you very much.
Epiphanies.
Part of the community. The next idea.
Good ideas normally come from the collision between smaller hunches so that they form something bigger than themselves.
Inclusion, acceptance, support. That's the mission of Play Place for Autistic Children. It's a 25,000 square foot facility in Sterling Heights in Macomb County. And there's no place like it in the country. PlayPlace is a nonprofit. It gives kids who are on the autism spectrum a safe, fun, comfortable place to hang out, to play, to be with others. And for parents and caregivers, it's a place to find a Me Too conversation with someone who's also going through the challenges of autism. Founder Shell Jones is here with us now. Shell, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so happy to be a part of it.
Tell us how you hit upon this idea.
Well, I would guess I would say unfortunately, but you know what? My son is really, really a blessing, you know, and that's how I look at it in a positive light. But he was diagnosed with autism at about 2.5. And so, you know, we would go out and people would stare and they'd whisper, and they still do. And I just kind of wanted to find a place that, you know, we could go out as a family and be accepted, you know, and not be looked upon with, you know, just insensitive behaviors because he had autism.
Yeah, so a place that's judgment-free and nobody throwing shade and giving sideways glances or rolling their eyes.
Exactly. Yes, and so PlayPlace is a place that it's a community that embraces families like mine. And unbeknownst to me at the time, Michigan is number 4 in the country affected by autism. We have over 50,000 individuals in the state that are diagnosed. And, of course, the number is, I'm sure, higher because there are cases that are undiagnosed.
You have built so many different elements into that 25,000 square feet of PlayPlace. Beginning with the design, what kinds of things needed to be built into the design to accommodate the needs of children who are on the spectrum?
What I did was I took it from a personal perspective, and I just kind of like put in things that we couldn't engage in with him having autism, like going to the movies. Because he has his iPad all the time, people aren't very accepting of that, of course not in the movies. And then he stims. Which is, you know, from the outside, that's what you would see when we're in public and he's kind of making noises, strange noises is what you would call it. And he may have, let's say, flapping behavior or something of that sort. And so we threw in a carousel simply because we found ourselves at Lakeside Mall often because he wanted to spin. He wanted that motion, that sensory input. And upon being there, we would run into other families that were affected by autism that were there for the very same reason, you know, and they were traveling from very far distance just to come and have that time on the carousel. And so, you know, I wanted it to be disguised by play, but I wanted it to be much more than that. So we threw in things like a Lego castle, where as from the outside looking in, it looks as if, you know, it's just idle play. But, you know, they have to use their pinchers, which is fine motor skills, to put the pieces together. Then there's color matching. Then there's shapes. There's imagination. There's creativity. Every element about the center has some type of therapeutic value to it, if you will. So we have a laser chalk room where all the walls are chalkboard and they can write. Again, that's fine motor. It helps them to practice handwriting skills. They come in and they do games, tic-tac-toe, things like that. So it's a form of socialization as well. We have an art studio. We have a computer cafe. We have a store where I've kind of worked in where a program, what's called our Work Plus program, where we want 50% of the staff of PlayPlace for autistic children to be either autism-affected or special needs-affected children or young adults, if you will, that can come in and receive vocational training and education so that they can perhaps go out into the community and increase the numbers of unemployment where it's 94% of our kids, they grow up and they're unemployed. And that's really sad.
You've built so much, and it's there for the youngsters, but you've got a lot for the parents and the caregivers and the family members.
Yes, this is a family center, so the entire family can come. And we use our siblings as like behavioral models, if you will, because they're actually indirectly affected as well, because there are times when, you know, I have a younger daughter, and we were at Kalahari, and she wanted to stay, but it turned into a situation where we went swimming, we went back up to the room to eat. She got into the bed because she was a little bit cold from the water, and she started eating. And so my son looked at that, and he equated that to, they think we're staying. And so he immediately put his food up, and he says, home, all done. And so my daughter's kind of trying to coax him into staying, but he wasn't really buying it. And so she said, you know what, Mom, I don't want him to cry, because he kind of started tearing up. She's like, I don't want him to cry, so let's leave. And so we did, you know, and I was very proud of her for that. But if she had her druthers, Cindy, she would have stayed.
Yeah.
But because of the autism, you know, there have been a lot of times where we couldn't go somewhere because it wasn't a welcoming environment for him. And so they're indirectly affected as well. And so you don't want it to turn into a thing where the neurotypical sibling is hampered by, you know, he gets all the attention and we never get to do anything, you know. So this is a place where the entire family can come and we can combat that 80% divorce rate because we have a bistro where the families can come out and have a date night, if you will, you know, and go to the movies together because they don't get that. The parents don't get that with this 24/7 challenge, you know. So
Yeah. And you have the resource nights. You're bringing professionals in to
exactly
offer support. I love the fact you have the haircut hut.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I totally forgot about that. And it's such a popular feature to what we're doing here because we can't take these kids to the barbershop. You can't take your neurotypical child to the barbershop in a lot of instances. We have a wonderful stylist named Carolyn. She really understands these kids and she knows how to work with them. And we block off an hour and sometimes it takes longer, but we're here for them and we're understanding and we care, you know.
So I'm hearing therapeutic efforts, play and healing and socialization, educational programming. And I know you're planning to open a retail store.
Yes, we actually have our store that's open now.
Wow. All of that under one roof. And this is the first facility of its kind in the country. And it seems like such a killer, great idea.
Yeah.
Why are there not more facilities like this, Shell?
That's the joke around our office. And so it's when we run into issues like the insurance as we were getting started. And it was like, okay, what is this going to look like in terms of insurance payments? And then we found that it wasn't as bad as we thought it was going to be. And even the insurance agent was surprised because we don't fit into any specific category because it is the first of its kind. So we don't fit into recreation and we don't fit into education because we're not a school. So it's like we're kind of running down the middle path and we're creating our own lane. It takes a minute to kind of break down those walls, but we're doing it. And so we imagine that that's probably, you know, no one has done this, you know, and we run into parents all the time that say, you know, this is what I wanted. This is a place that I've dreamed of before, you know.
And it is a big place. It's so well planned and implemented. So obviously a lot of money went into it, but you're a nonprofit. So give us an idea because people are probably listening going, wow, how could we do this? What's the financial model for PlayPlace?
So it took like $1.7 million to build, and it's huge. That's a huge number, especially for a mom with no other experience, no business experience, actually. But you know what? It was such a community effort in that 90% of that $1.7 million was donated. Can you believe it? I mean, we connected with the unions from the carpenters to the sheet metals to the pipe fitters. I never knew there were so many unions. And they all came together, and it was like a snowball effect where the carpenters called the sprinkler fitters, and then the sprinkler fitters called, let's say, Ferndale Electric, and they came on board along with the IBEW union, which is the electrical union, with an over $200,000 donation of lightings because we switched over from fluorescent, which causes sometimes meltdowns in the kids and other issues because they can hear the buzzing and the flickering because of their high sensory levels. And they switched everything over to LED, no charge to us, you know. It was just a huge community effort, I mean, of parents and corporate leaders. And, I mean, it was just a blessing, truly.
If someone wanted to open a similar play place, what do's and don'ts would you have for them?
What I would suggest is that the programming is key. I think to just open a place like this without any particular input in terms of programming, I don't know if it would work or not. I mean, you have to kind of create things for these families to do and engage them and keep them coming back because what happens is they want to come in where there are other parents that they can talk with and there are other kids that are similar to their child and that they can, you know, socialize with. So if you engage these families with things that they need that maybe they didn't think of before, like nutrition, how do I get my child to eat properly, or he's such a picky eater because of the disorder, how can I sneak this nutrition in and he still be, you know, happy with what he's being offered to eat?
So you need to rely on experts and get input. Certainly a visit to see what you have done, I think, would be very, very helpful, too, so you could get a sense of that. What ages would you say PlayPlace is best suited for?
So we do all ages. the oldest patron that we've engaged or connected with was 52 years old. So it's for all ages. We have a teen night on Wednesdays. We have a Friday fun night on Fridays for 18 plus. So it attracts or caters to all ages on the spectrum.
It's a remarkable place, and really we want to congratulate you on what you've been able to accomplish. And again, the first of its kind in the nation. And you can learn more about Play Place for Autistic Children by checking out the website autisticplayplace.org. That's autisticplayplace.org. Shell Jones, thank you for sharing your vision and your work with us and being with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How do we talk about Detroit? In the 80s and 90s, the focus was on crime and urban decay, Detroit as the murder city. Today, the narrative is one of possibility and resurgence. But both of these depictions are largely imposed by outsiders and are, at best, incomplete. Rebecca Kinney explores the narratives of Detroit's history in her new book, Beautiful Wasteland: The Rise of Detroit as America's Post-Industrial Frontier. Rebecca Kinney teaches in the School of Cultural and Critical Studies and the Department of Popular Culture at Bowling Green State University, and she grew up in Metro Detroit. Rebecca, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
What were you seeing or hearing that got you wanting to explore this question of the rise of Detroit as America's post-industrial frontier in this book?
Yeah, so I, you know, as you mentioned, I grew up in Metro Detroit, and I spent about a decade living in California, first in Northern California and Southern California, working and then going to graduate school. And during that decade, living outside of Michigan, whenever people would find out, you know, I was from Detroit, there was always this moment of pause. And then there was always a follow-up question. You know, wow, you know, you're Asian. I didn't realize there were Asians in Detroit. Other questions would be, you know, wow, what's it like to live there? How'd you get out alive? And so I would always follow up and say, oh, well, tell me about, you know, when you were last in Detroit, or, you know, tell me how you know about the city. And more often than not, people would always say, oh, well, I've never been there. You know, these are just things that I heard or that I know. And long about maybe the early 2010s, people would start to follow up instead of with those questions that I was used to and expecting and having, you know, my answers ready to go, would really follow up with these questions of, or statements of, I hear there's really interesting things happening in Detroit, or I heard Detroit is such, you know, a place on the rise. And again, I would always ask, how do you, you know, come to know these stories? Tell me about the last time you were in Detroit. And again, most of the people saying this to me would often remark that they had never been to Detroit.
So you realize there were a lot of things shaping people's view of Detroit that had nothing to do with anybody setting foot in the city.
Right. Exactly. And so that's really where kind of the motivation for the book comes from, is really about how are the narratives told about Detroit by both former Detroiters as well as people around the nation and the world. How do they stand in for the narratives that are known about this city? And so in many ways, although I'm a Metro Detroiter, I don't necessarily claim myself as a Detroiter. And I think that that's an important perspective and note, that my motivation and really standpoint in writing the book is really to think about how Detroit is framed from an outside perspective.
But you're a good one to do it because you've grown up here. You know it. So it isn't like so many stories that have been done,
right,
where people come in. I know Time Magazine set up that house in,
right,
Detroit, and we're going to embed people like as if it's in a combat zone,
right,
in Iraq. But yeah, so you've got a sense of how outsiders view Detroit and the Detroit area.
Right.
And you've grown up here.
Right. And I think that it's a really important kind of tension in line, because as a Metro Detroiter, I realize that Detroit and the metropolitan area has been willfully divided for so many decades. Mm-hmm. And really thinking about the importance of, you know, highlighting that division in both the history of Detroit's rise, fall narrative, as well as highlighting that division in the narrative of the return and the rise of Detroit.
Yeah.
Because I think that that's an important piece that is missed, particularly as so many Metro Detroiters are now re-embracing the city in the 21st century. I think that it's this important moment of, you know, kind of pushing back against this re-embrace without questioning what factors led to and contributed to the decline of the city.
In Beautiful Wasteland, Rebecca, you explore all these different narratives of Detroit through the 20th and the 21st century using advertising and ruin photography, which many call ruin porn, mm-hmm. or print, film, media, conversation threads you found online, all kinds of sources. Can you give us a sense of the story arc that you found for Detroit, starting, let's say, in the 1980s, early 90s, and taking us up to today?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the story arc is something that I like to refer to as the standard narrative of Detroit. Really, you have to go back a little bit further, I would argue, to the 20s and 30s, right, to the narrative of Henry Ford's $5 day, which people, again, kind of take that as a standard narrative without looking at that back research that realizes that $5 day was profit sharing, required you to meet certain class citizenship standards, behavior and comportment standards. So it wasn't just this easy kind of,
hey, everybody, come on in.
Exactly. So yes. I think that the standard narrative really goes back to kind of the early 20th century, wherein there's a narrative that work was available for anybody who wanted work. And it really kind of elides the divisions between race, gender, class and citizenship that mediated access to work even then. But the standard narrative, you know, really suggests that if you came to Detroit, particularly in the mid-20th century, you could find a job on the line without a high school education. That job would afford you the ability to buy a home, to send your children to good schools.
Maybe get a cottage up north.
Exactly. Like, so really to live that American dream. And while that narrative bore out to be true for many, many Detroiters, and I don't want to, you know, disregard that or take mm-hmm. that away. It wasn't a narrative that was available to all Detroiters. And so that's the standard narrative of rise. And then the standard narrative of fall really pivots typically around the 1967 rebellion, although as the book aims to show that 1967 was not a catalytic moment. It was actually kind of a moment in which what had already existed in terms of decentralization of industry in terms of suburbanization was simply amplified, but was not the moment at which this massive change happened. And so right around that moment, though, there's a national narrative of Detroit's decline or fall.
The white flight.
The white flight.
Yes.
I mean, I think that population bears that out mm-hmm. and statistics bear it out. And what I'm really interested in is the ways in which the narrative of Detroit's rise is seen as and written as and conceptualized as a race-neutral project, so that it's not actually about race, it's not actually about white privilege, for example, but indeed it's about this universal access to Detroit's rise. And when the narrative of Detroit's fall emerges, as I write about in chapter one of the book in particular, it's always narrated as this influx of black population primarily mm-hmm. and the decline of white population. And so what I'm aiming to do is to really question how that narrative makes white privilege invisible. And so how does this narrative of white flight then create this narrative of black city that is in decline, rather than looking at the other side of white flight, for example, which is indeed the white suburbanization and the subsidization of property ownership in the suburban periphery. And so I think that that's an important piece.
And sucking life out of the city, in a sense.
Right, in terms of taxes, in terms
right.
of spending dollars.
But then that sets up, so here we are where things are looking more optimistic as Detroit has gotten its way through this historic bankruptcy,
right.
gotten through it in pretty record time,
right.
and now we're back to, and even the words to use, is it the resurrection of Detroit? Is it the reshaping? Is it the, you know, what is it? And that is really very much depending on who you're talking to.
Right. And I think that it's this important moment and what the book, you know, really hopes to show or asks us to pause and think about is that there, even still, even in this moment leading up to the bankruptcy, there was over 650,000 people living in Detroit, well up and through, you know, I think that's the 2010 census number. Mm-hmm. And even still, there was this narrative that Detroit is empty or depopulated or this space that's completely open for development, you know, this new frontier for people to move to, you know, pin their hopes and dreams on. And I think that once again, we see the ways in which the racial logics of place emerge to write a place that has over 650,000 people as empty because indeed it's primarily black. And so the ways in which the invisibility of whiteness emerges again and again in the story of Detroit, particularly in its late 20th century and early 21st century narrative, is a central piece of focus for the book.
I'm talking with Rebecca Kinney. Her book, Beautiful Wasteland, The Rise and of Detroit as America's Post-Industrial Frontier, looking at, as you say, these story arcs about Detroit, what they're missing. When we talk about this comeback of Detroit, what would be a more accurate storyline, do you think?
I mean, I think that, you know, the way I close out the book, thinking about how so much of Detroit's rebirth, quote unquote, and rise is written within the 7.2 square mile greater downtown area. So the area that's been deemed kind of this focus of redevelopment by a nonprofit consortia of groups. Mm-hmm. Is really only 5% of Detroit's story. And so to focus on only what's happening in, you know, this tight, finite area of Corktown, of Midtown, of downtown, of the riverfront, leaves out all of the other stories of Detroiters who have long existed within those neighborhoods, and then also the 95% of the city outside of that area.
When you think about that area, and you touch on this, you know, after you've researched and written this book, I'm wondering what thoughts you came away with about those big name developers who are spending big money, mainly in downtown Detroit, but, you know, the Illich family, certainly Dan Gilbert. So here you have Dan Gilbert, who's bought more than $1 billion in office, retail, and residential property downtown, and you see some who hail him as a major driver in getting downtown Detroit pumped up again and kicking, because there were some pretty long and bleak years. Mm-hmm. You have others who think he's not doing anything to help the residents of Detroit, only to enrich his bottom line. Mm-hmm. What do you think, after all of the research you've done, about these views?
I think that, you know, from my perspective, Dan Gilbert is most invested in Dan Gilbert and most invested in creating a quote-unquote thriving downtown playscape for, you know, his workers, for tourists, for the people he's trying to attract to the city, so that ultimately his real estate investments will pay off in the end. I do think that he has bought, and this is even an outdated number, so as of this past summer, I'm sure that there's been more, within 5 years, it was $1.2 billion worth of property. That amount of investment in such a concentrated, finite area is bound to change a city in such a dramatic fashion, and so quickly. And I think that, you know, any of us who are familiar with the city for longer than 5 years or 10 years, just the pure amount of building change and the changes in the physical landscape are undeniable, but also the changes in terms of the either you're with us or against us kind of narrative of Detroit's development. So if we think back to this past November's election and the defeat of Prop A, so much of the rhetoric around the anti-Prop A folks was that if we vote for this, right, or if you vote for this.
The community benefits. A and B.
And A had a lower threshold by which a developer would need to then give back to community.
And engage with a community group, right. Neighborhood group, yes.
And it failed. And part of the reason it failed, I think, was because of the huge campaign around it to ensure that it would fail, which basically, you know, so many people boil down to that if this passes, then nobody will develop in Detroit again and, you know, will be the Detroit of 10 years ago. And so to me, that is both kind of a scare tactic. And then also it gives me pause to consider what is that Detroit of 10 years ago that, you know, that the people who are purporting this are so afraid of? Because I think that for me, I will never forget that in 2014, when the first Detroit Homecoming Conference was held, bringing back Detroit expats. Yep. From around the country and around the world.
Get back down to Detroit and share and talk.
Right, and they recently just had their third homecoming conference. But in the Detroit Homecoming One, wherein Dan Gilbert interviewed Warren Buffett on stage, right, the billion-dollar stage, I will never forget that it was quoted that Warren Buffett said that, you know, now is the time to invest in Detroit. If we look back to New York of the 1970s, nobody could have ever imagined that New York of the 1970s would become the New York of today. So to me, when somebody like Warren Buffett really suggests that the potential that Detroit of the 2010s is going to be the New York of the 1970s gives me great pause, because the New York of today is unaffordable and out of reach, not just for working people and poor people, but for middle class people. The New York of today is ruled by financial elites from around the world as opposed to a local body. I do think that, you know, in Detroit, the ways in which the massive amounts of development of Dan Gilbert and Bedrock Industries mm-hmm. happened simultaneous to the state takeover and installment of an emergency financial manager mm-hmm. and then the subsequent bankruptcy of the city cannot be underplayed in terms of the significance of those moments together. Because as the city itself lost so much of its power for self-governance during that moment of emergency financial management, and even still is rather weakened by that mm-hmm. Plan through bankruptcy, you had a private investor, Dan Gilbert, rising as a huge voice in how the future of Detroit would be built, would be paid for, would be imagined. And, you know, unlike a mayor or a city council member, Dan Gilbert can't be unelected. Dan mm-hmm. Gilbert, you know, has no constituency beyond his stakeholders, beyond the people who invest in his companies.
Is it a bad thing to see buildings being refurbished, getting revived, getting new life, and then being used, being, you know, buildings that had been decaying and empty for years and years and years are suddenly happening with residential or retail? Is that a bad thing?
No, and yeah. I do not think that development, you know, mm-hmm. is a bad thing. And I want that to be clear. But I do think that the scale in which the development is happening, the ways in which so much public subsidy of these developments is happening. So, for example,
the Red Wings, the Little Caesars Arena. Yeah.
And then the conversation now about the Pistons owner mm-hmm. and, you know, he'll move the Pistons downtown if there's a $34.5 million tax subsidy. So the ways in which these big time investors rely on public subsidy, that is why mm-hmm. it's not just investment. Second to that, if you look at something like the M1 Detroit streetcar line, or, you know, now mm-hmm. it's known as the Q line, if you look at that, it's, again, primarily funded by private investors. It does receive a little bit of public subsidy. But importantly, it took over, I mean, Woodward Avenue for about 2 years, right? It took up, I mean, we all sat in that traffic, you know, went around the traffic cones. I mean, it took up public space, and it will continue to take up public space in a public street for the ongoing future. And so I think that those are the questions that when the public is subsidizing an investment that has the potential to benefit only a very few of the public in a city the size and scale of Detroit, that's when it gives me pause.
You pose this question in your book, Rebecca, why is Detroit such a compelling story? So I want to put that question to you. Why do you think Detroit has this ability to capture the national imagination?
You know, I think and I do think that part of what I do in the book is really seek to answer why Detroit, why now? And I think that so much of this compelling part of Detroit in the 20-teens is deeply related to the recession, the national and the global recession of 2008. Because I think that the resurgence of Ford and GM post-auto mm-hmm. bailout mm-hmm. Became national and international headlines in what could be, you know, argued was such a deeply depressing kind of moment for the country economically, that there became this narrative that if Detroit can make a comeback, mm. then anywhere can make a comeback. And so in this way, Detroit, again, was able to stand in for a place that had really, you know, reached the bottom of the barrel, but yet was still thriving and still surviving.
Well, as your book puts it, the upcycled version of the American dream. Mm-hmm. Beautiful Wasteland, The Rise of Detroit as America's Post-Industrial Frontier, written by my guest, Rebecca J. Kinney. Great to talk with you, Rebecca. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.